Greetings, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton, the creator and host of the series, and for anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. I convened this series several years ago to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a real role in helping the human species rise to meet our current challenges to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've now conducted just over 100 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today, I'm joined by David Loy, and we're going to continue that discussion in a conversation entitled The Politics of Buddhism, Awakening from Institutionalized Greed, Ill Will, and Delusion. The way this will work is that I'll introduce David and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then we'll make some announcements and spend about a half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in about 90 minutes or perhaps a little longer. David Loy is a professor, writer, and Zen teacher in the Sambo Kyodan tradition of Japanese Zen Buddhism. He's a prolific author whose essays and books, including Money, Sex, War, Karma, and The Great Awakening, have been translated into many languages. His articles appear regularly in the pages of major journals such as Tikkun and Buddhist magazines, including Tricycle, Turning Wheel, Shambhala Sun, and Buddha Dharma, as well as in a variety of scholarly journals. A professor of Buddhist and comparative philosophy, David lectures nationally and internationally on various topics, focusing primarily on the encounter between Buddhism and modernity, what each can learn from the other. He is especially concerned about social and ecological issues. I first became aware of David almost 20 years ago when I devoured his truly terrific book, Lack and Transcendence. It's a profound companion volume to Ernest Becker's great classic, The Denial of Death. A deep examination of how anatta, the Buddhist doctrine of no self, intersects with the Freudian ideal of psychological repression. With keen intelligence, this book, which, by the way, I highly recommend, opens up the anatomy of the persistent sense of lack and how it motivates so many seemingly innocent human activities and, in fact, pervades human life and culture. I finally met him in person 3 years ago when I moderated a panel at a conference with him on non-duality and social change. And I discovered that we share a lifelong passion for deeply contemplating and being changed by this universal, what I call Genjo Koan of our time, the disorienting, impossible question that changes your consciousness and that you cannot avoid, the animating question of this very series, our world crisis and how we can be the change we want to see in the world. So it feels really auspicious, just right, that he and I are finally meeting again in this context, and I'm hoping we can take this consideration into deep new territory, really finding ourselves in new places and passionately. So thanks so much for joining me here today, David.
Well, thank you, Terry, for that, first of all, for the invitation, and also for that very warm introduction. I really appreciate it. And I also need to begin by apologizing. I checked on a little bit late because of some phone trouble, but I'm very delighted to be with you for this conversation.
Yeah, great. Well, it might be useful for us to begin by laying a foundation. And it seems that your deep exploration of Buddhist psychology and Western psychology in terms of really understanding this core insight of Buddhism, the persistent human experience of lack, is maybe the foundation for the conversation we want to have today. Perhaps you could begin by getting everybody on the same page about that.
Sure. Well, it's my way of trying to understand and articulate what I think is really the most important teaching of the Buddha. The connection that he makes between dukkha, suffering in the broadest sense of the word, including not only physical and mental pain, but also basic frustration, dissatisfaction, the fact that life never seems to be going quite as well as we'd like it to. Connecting that concept with the other very interesting Buddhist concept of anatta, or not self. And basically the way I understand it is that the Buddha is he's making two points. First of all, he's emphasizing the delusion of a separate self, the idea that there's a me inside and that the rest of the world is somehow outside myself. And he's also emphasizing that there's a fundamental dukkha, suffering, or dissatisfaction built into it. And the way I understand that is that we don't usually understand where that dissatisfaction is coming from. So often we become preoccupied with thinking that we can resolve it or fill it up by identifying or gaining certain things out in the world, money, fame, whatever. Because we don't understand what's really going on there, I think we experience this sort of sense of separation as a sense of lack, as the feeling that there's something fundamentally wrong with me, something isn't quite right about my life, something is missing. And I think this is something all of us are aware of, but we're not usually aware that everyone else has it as well. We tend to think that it's our own problem. We're not aware that other people are also trying to cope with the same fundamental difficulty. And so the fundamental delusion here, which causes so much problem, is that we tend to understand the sense of lack as something that can be filled by gaining things outside ourselves, as I said, rather than realizing that it's really a spiritual problem that requires a very different kind of solution.
And you've gone a little further and connected that to, first maybe we should connect the dots to the three poisons. That might expand it a little bit. And I'm where I'm heading is how that, in a sense, has become institutionalized in our world in a way that is, you know, far more complex and interconnected than ever before.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, in the book that you read, Lack and Transcendence, the focus wasn't at all on the social dimension. It was very much on the individual. So it's understanding how it is that we get caught up with certain obsessive drives, like drive to accumulate money or consumer goods or a drive to become famous or a drive maybe to find the perfect romantic or sexual partner. I think those are three of the classic examples. Because our culture tends to condition us according to the kind of person we are, according to the kind of society we grow up in, it tends to condition us to understand what it is that we need to do in order to fill up this sense of lack. So at that level, there was a lot of focus on understanding, but using the Buddhist approach to understanding our sense of lack to also help us see why it is that these, what I sometimes call reality projects or lack projects, become so compulsive, so obsessive for us. But the interesting thing, of course, just looking at money, for example, it's not just that I have this problem, perhaps, where I become obsessed with becoming rich. That becomes the most important thing. But we also have a society that has a problem insofar as that encourages us to all of us to get caught up in that kind of a game. And then later, reflecting further on that, I could see more of the social and political implications of this. How, for example, especially if we look at what the Buddha called the three poisons. The Buddha didn't say much about evil, but sometimes the three poisons are described as the roots of evil. And they're basically three very problematical motivations from a Buddhist perspective, greed, ill will, and delusion. And really, the Buddha's teaching about karma, I think what he's basically pointing out is that when what we do is motivated by these poisons, and they tend to work together, of course, then we create problematic situations for ourselves, and how important it is to transform our motivations from greed to generosity, from ill will to loving kindness, from delusion to the kind of wisdom that understands and acknowledges our basic interdependence, that we're not separate from each other, that my well-being isn't separate from your well-being. But what struck me in thinking further about this from a social or larger collective perspective is that we do seem to have a problem today that the Buddha didn't have to face, that today we have institutionalized these three poisons, institutionalized in the sense that it's not only that they're collective, but they actually have ended up taking on a life of their own. So I think that we've institutionalized greed. I think that's a very good way to understand our economic system. If greed means you never have enough, you always want more, where I think that describes pretty well the fact that consumers never have enough, corporations are never profitable enough, national GNP or GDP is never big enough. And it's not simply that there's this obsession with growth, but that it has taken on a life of its own in the sense that these institutions, for example, corporations, by the very way that they're structured, they tend to focus on this quite apart from the motivations of the individuals involved. What I mean by that is, for example, if the CEO of a fossil fuel corporation wakes up one morning and he realizes how dangerous our ecological situation is and he really wants to do something about it. But if the kind of changes that he wants to bring into the corporation are going to affect profits, well, it's more than likely that he will lose his job. And if that's true for the CEO, how much more true it is for everyone else down the line within that corporation. So that's what I mean by how the motivations have actually become impersonal and institutionalized. Likewise, I think we've institutionalized ill will in a couple of different ways. You could look at our prison system, for example. Why it is that the United States, only about 5% of the world's population, has at least 25% of the world's inmates. But I think the best example of the institution of ill will, institutionalization of ill will, is our militarism, really. If you measure that by, if you look at the enormous amount of resources that we put into our military system, we are certainly by far the most militarized society or nation in human history. And again, the danger of that is if you put so much money into the military, you're in a situation where you have to keep finding enemies, you have to keep fighting wars in order to justify that. So when communism more or less collapsed back in the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, that was a real problem for the Pentagon, but now we have the war on terror, which in a way might go on forever. I mean, it's already the longest war in our history, and who knows if it will end or when or how would we know? I mean, given the kind of enemies that involves, given the fact that we tend to be reproducing those enemies in the way that we prosecute the war with drones, for example, creating more people who hate us. I think that's a real classic example of a kind of institutionalization of national ill will. And then finally, delusion. And I think we can look at a couple things there. We could look at our educational system, which I think is less and less about understanding what's really going on and more about being a form of job training. But in particular, I tend to focus on the media, especially the main corporate media, which really aren't there to educate or inform us. They're mega corporations interested in profit, and they make their profit from advertising, of course. So their primary interest is finding ways to grab our eyeballs and sell them to the highest bidder. Which means that part of their project is going to be working consciously and unconsciously, to sort of normalize the kind of consumerism and economic growth that's going on now. They're really not about fulfilling what I think the fathers of the Constitution originally thought. Rather, it's very much part of the same economic consumer network. So putting those three together, it's pretty scary, but this, I think, offers a somewhat different kind of analysis than we would normally get from the usual social justice perspective, which is not denying or minimizing that in any way, but I think this Buddhist perspective emphasizing how these three have become so interwoven and so powerful does give us a different light on what's going on now.
And that implies a dramatic change, you know, would be the politics, right? That a Buddhist politics would be somehow the enactment of a radical transformation of society. That seems to follow logically. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. The other thing I forgot to mention, of course, which is something you and I and probably all the listeners are aware of course, is that the political system, especially at the national level, is pretty much completely captured or largely captured by these corporate interests. I mean, basically, what happens is what mega corporations and very wealthy people want to happen, rather than being a true democracy. So, in other words, the political system is really at this point largely complicit with the kind of problems that I was talking about a moment ago.
So then let's just continue to take this logic where it goes. I, as an individual, understanding that I am tending to feel a subtle quality of lack and anxiety and guilt and insufficiency, can be a serious practitioner and allow myself to understand the existential roots of that kind of orientation and to some degree wake up. And that's often conventionally called the inner work. And I can see these patterns and then I can do something to address them, which is conventionally called the outer work. And that might include any of the normal forms of political activism, from signing petitions to donating money to going to demonstrations to voting to working for candidates to giving my time and volunteering and so forth. But the critique, in a way, somehow I think asks for us to go beyond the obvious behaviors and orientations that we've already discussed, that right now you and I are confronted by what I called in the introduction, you know, this global Genja koan, like how can we really be something different? And having laid out the problem, I think that the juice of our conversation might come from us, you know, really delving into that. And I'm curious to hear kind of the current state of your contemplation of how you can really be have integrity and participate, and not just be another anxiety-based progressive political activist who's bringing his own anxiety forward and imposing it on others, and just adding to the general delusion, just with a different critique and orientation.
You know, Terry, sometimes I think that the most important thing that Buddhism can contribute is a new understanding of what might be called the Bodhisattva path. I'm not sure how familiar this is to all the listeners, but so this is the Buddhist understanding that it's important not just to become preoccupied with our own awakening, but to help other people. Now, conventionally in Asia, this would mean, first of all, and primarily helping other people awaken, but it would also work on a service level. And I think the comparable version of that in the United States is generally accepted. That it's a valuable thing for Buddhist practitioners to get involved in things like helping the homeless, or prison dharma, teaching the dharma in prisons, or hospice work. But so far, it seems to me, is we're having more trouble connecting with the institutional or structural challenges. In other words, I think that Buddhists, for example, have become a lot better in the past generation, pulling drowning people out of the river. But I don't know that we've gotten better at all in asking, you know, why there are so many more drowning people. Who or what is pushing them in the river upstream, around the bend, you see. There's a famous saying by a Brazilian Archbishop, Dom Helder Kumara, who was quoted as saying that when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. But when I ask why there are so many poor, they call me a communist. Well, I think there's still a kind of Buddhist version, and not just Buddhist, but often a spiritual, generally spiritual version of this that says, yes, it's good to engage in service things. It's good to be a bodhisattva and help homeless people, for example. But when we want to look at the more difficult and more challenging structural issues, then many people do tend to back away from that and say, no, that's not Buddhism, that's not spirituality. And this is quite fascinating, because when you look at Buddhism, for example, every time Buddhism has come to a new culture, it has transformed quite dramatically. It doesn't just impose itself. It interacts, it engages with the local traditions. And I think part of what's going on now that Buddhism comes to the West is engaging in a sort of postmodern global civilization where social justice is extremely important, and also where we find ourselves confronted by some very serious challenges. For one thing, climate change or the ecological crisis in general really seems to be the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced. And I think it's a really important question for Buddhism and all other spiritual traditions to ask just what they can contribute. But the important point about the Bodhisattva path is that the Bodhisattva has a double practice. He or she combines continued work on their own personal individual development, their own meditation and whatsoever, but they also realize that it's not sufficient just to do that. It's also necessary to go out and work in society. And that it's the combination of those two that I think is so powerful and that is so much needed today. So in response to your concern about not just being activists who are anxious and, as we know, get frustrated, get burnt out, get angry, tend to dualize, and so forth. I think if we can combine these two practices, or maybe we should even call them two sides of the same practice, if we can bring these two together, it seems to me that that's really what the world needs right now.
Well, certainly. And yet, it seems to me clear that spiritual activism, you know, which is something that both of you and I have been contemplating for decades and engaged with for a long period of time, is a very small movement. It is slight in its effect on the actual decisions that are governing human affairs right now. So for me, the gap between aspiration and reality always presses me into a deep contemplation, a kind of the way that I'm being both a practitioner, you might say, doing the inner work, and an activist doing the outer work, is provisional. I may be doing the best I can. I may be doing both things. I may be able to turn to someone else and point out the value of what I've already understood, and that's certainly that has value. That's perhaps what we've done so far in the dialogue. But the fruitful turf is what lies ahead. How can I be a more effective practitioner and activist? Mm-hmm. How can I grow in this? How can we all grow in this? That be pressing into the demand that the emergency of the condition of human affairs, you know, confronts us with, is a goad to transformation. This is how emergence happens in
mm-hmm.
evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Crisis conditions actually bring something new into being that hasn't existed before. And if we're to be
mm-hmm.
serious practitioners, we would want to make our own consciousness and our own behavior a lightning rod for that new potential. And a conversation
mm-hmm.
such as this might be a place where we can contemplate that deeply and authentically and begin to edge out into territory that where hopefully you or I will be saying something we've never said before that somehow begins to spark something that is the space
mm-hmm.
of that coming into being. That would be the highest, best outcome of this discourse, it would seem
mm-hmm.
to me. So what about it? You know, let's lean in.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I think is so important about the Bodhisattva path is that one thing we learn in our spiritual practice, in what you're calling the inner work, is a certain kind of non-attachment. I mean, when we meditate, it's largely letting go of one thing and another. And I think that kind of non-attachment is exactly what's called for, and it's something sort of fresh and powerful in our social activism as well. Not attachment, not to the fate of the earth, not attachment to, you know, what's actually happening, but in terms of our own projects, in terms of what we're trying to achieve in the world, inevitably there's going to be frustration, there's going to be setbacks, and I think because of the ability in our own personal practice, sort of touch these quiet places, these Buddhism, we talk about emptiness or deep equanimity, touch the place where there's, I mean, and this is the paradox. From that perspective, there's nothing lacking. There's nothing that needs to be done. There's nothing that needs to be gained. And yet we know that that's not sufficient. It's not enough just to sort of reside there. We have to go and also go out in the world and respond to what Shunryu Suzuki Roshi was doing when he spoke to his students and he said, you know, you're all perfect just as you are, but you all need a little improvement too. The challenge of this new Bodhisattva path, as I see it, is combining those two in the way that we relate to the world. And what I see is essential is that empowers us to do the very best that we can, not knowing if anything we do makes any difference whatsoever, because that's a lot of the problem too. We get discouraged. These problems are so immense. It's hard to avoid feeling overwhelmed and depressed about it. And yet, from the spiritual perspective, we can see that we don't know what's happening. We don't know what the possibilities are. Things might indeed be too late in ecological terms. And yet, from a deep practitioner standpoint, that doesn't make any difference. It doesn't detract from our fundamental responsibility to do the very best we can, not knowing, again, if any of that makes any difference. I have to say, too, if I can add to this, I don't see that Buddhism, at least, just focusing on that for the moment, I don't see that Buddhism gives us any specific answers in terms of what we should be doing. In other words, Buddhism, there's nothing in the Buddhist tradition that tells us really how to respond, say, to capitalism or nuclear weapons or even the kind of ecological crisis we have now. It doesn't give us specifics, but the Bodhisattva path, for example, has a lot to say about how we engage, as I've tried to point to. But as you also mentioned, the role of spiritual activists here is going to be relatively small, I think. And yet I wonder if we have something very special to offer. I suppose you're familiar with Paul Hawkins' book, Blessed Unrest.
Sure.
One
of the things that's important in that book is that I think made an impact was his pointing out that there are over 1 million NGOs that are trying to do good work in one way or another.
Right. And now I think he would estimate it's well over 2 million. I think he mentions that in one of his TED Talks. But the point is, first of all, this is something that's never happened before in the history of humanity. And it, it does seem to be something like the immune system of the earth springing up to defend itself. You know, these groups, mostly small, are basically there to work for social justice and sustainability. And this is quite amazing. I tend to see that as reflecting or manifesting a kind of change of consciousness, part of that evolutionary development that you were talking about in your introduction. And I see spiritual traditions like Buddhism as fairly small parts of that, but also perhaps parts that have something rather distinctive to offer. Because if you look, say, at the history of social transformation, certainly in Europe and the West generally, because of its Marxist and socialist roots, there's been often a kind of anti-religious bias there, because, you know, Marxists and socialists are well aware how often religious institutions have been complicit in the kind of systems of oppression, how often they've worked with kings and aristocracies and powerful people to rationalize and encourage us to accept inequitable situations. So what I think is so important about something like Buddhism, and not just Buddhism, is offering a different understanding of the spiritual path, that the spiritual path isn't about living in such a way that you qualify for some special fate after you die, but it's about transforming ourselves here and now so that we live in the world in a very different way. And this again brings us back to the Bodhisattva path. So it seems to me this is something that could be potentially be very valuable. If we can bring the activists together with this tendency to burn out and get frustrated, and bring that together with all the people, so many of the people working on their own personal transformation, if we can see the essential non-duality there, the necessity to bring those two together, then, well, who knows what could happen. But that's my hope. When I look, say, at the Buddhist tradition in the West and how it's developing, I can see some movement in that direction. Yeah.
Well, you know, I see little incremental movements in all those directions, too, and I feel that that's what my life's work is about, in a sense, is moving that forward in various ways, both in terms of helping people have a more profound and truly transformative personal practice and finding ways for that personal practice to express itself as effective care for others in the world around them. But this awareness of collision with environmental limits and critical breakdowns of larger human institutions, and a lot of these crises converging at the same time. In some sense, the crisis that is most real, in my view, is certainly, you know, climate change is huge, destruction of ocean quality, various environmental issues, all of those things are huge, but it's not only an environmental crisis, because we have issues right. with breakdown in economic and financial systems, political institutions, international cooperative institutions breaking down in various ways. We're seeing a convergence of crises, and that
right.
meta crisis is sort of really what's going on. What we're facing is all of that, and all of us are now, you know, pretty sophisticated thinkers. We can think globally. We can see patterns, and even patterns of patterns. You know, meta perspectives is a really educated, insightful person with a synthetic intelligence is adding it up and seeing what's going on. And then there's this dilemma of personal insignificance. In the face of all this, seeing how interconnected it is, as you pointed out, there tends to be a kind of discouragement. And yes, there's a spiritual point that we can be true in whatever ways we can be true and find a kind of peace and clarity in simply being the change in the ways we know how to be without knowing that it can change everything. For me, what arrived at a certain point was that I realized that it was a deep psychological issue, that some part of me was trying to make my full, wholehearted, hopeful commitment to social and cultural and political transformation. I wanted to make it contingent on me seeing a strategic path through which my activism could turn it all around. Some part of me didn't want to invest 100% of my energy in the project if I didn't see how it was all going to work out, and I didn't see a path to victory. And the idea that I might be laboring after some horrible point of no return that was going to take us to some point of evolutionary cultural regression, some kind of dystopian future, you know, that was sort of too horrible to contemplate. And I had to go through a real dark night of the soul, a real crisis in which I finally found my way to realizing that even under the worst conditions, I would want to be the presence of health, the presence of love, the presence of the thing that would have been able to have turned it all around if it could have been turned around, you know. I would want to be living my life in that way, even under the worst case scenario. And that in fact, to take that seriously, to honor the beauty of that form of life was a critical thing in liberating my energy, realizing that we just don't know. We don't know what will happen. Mm-hmm. We don't know what level of efficacy we can have personally. And that can liberate us to be fully engaged and living our lives. It's actually a self-actualizing epiphany if one really goes through it. Wow! I can just give myself heart and soul to being the change in every way I know how to be. And maybe it'll work and maybe it won't, but I will live a self-actualized life in the dusk of the human story or whenever it is, who knows, but I'll still be given over to it. And that liberates a certain energy, and that's been critical for me. But I feel then that there's something else, because, you know, one of the gifts of the integral theory out of which I have come into the work I'm doing now by working with Ken Wilber is this simple idea of the quadrants, that there are irreducible domains of human experience. And one of them is individual, my interior life and what's meaningful to me in my own action. Another is, though, my cultural surround. Like, I have to find others who are also awake enough to this that we can join together and begin to become a culture that is alive in this. And if we're effective, then we can bring this all the way to the fourth quadrant, which is the systems. We can actually maybe change larger systems. And it would only be when all of those things coincided that there would be, you might say, a full self-actualized existence. And that's kind of the project I'm contemplating. And because I know that you've gone into this very deeply, particularly at the level of psychology and even sociology, and I suspect you might help me take this even further, and that's kind of where I'm driving, you know?
Well, I mean, I think you've expressed that very beautifully. What I was trying to point to earlier when I mentioned the idea of non-attachment, that, I mean, our American culture is very sort of problem-solving, goal-oriented, right? We've got a problem. Let's just go out and solve it. And that kind of psychology doesn't really work here in the sense that the problems, the challenges are so immense, we can't figure it out in the way that you just described, that our job is to do what we can with what in Zen we emphasize as don't know mind. I appreciate especially your reference to community, because frankly I think that may be our number one problem within the Buddhist world, and part of the solution is definitely doing a better job of developing that. I mean, in terms of the three, you know, traditional Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, I mean, we have lots of teachers, we have lots of teachings, but often American Buddhism has followed the sort of traditional American individualism. So in the Zen world, you You go and you meditate silently, you listen to the great teacher and have a maybe one-on-one dialogue with him. But we haven't been that good at creating the kind of community. There are exceptions, but in general, I think this is really one of the big challenges that we're facing today, and that's going to be essential in order to face the crises that are coming down. From what you said, I sense we share the same sense, the same concern. I mean, things are breaking down, and they're breaking down in ways that they're interacting with each other. I think the two most obvious are economic and ecological. And a lot of the challenge for us not knowing what to do is we're not sure how they're going to break down. In other words, and there's also going to be that kind of mutual reinforcement together. But when I look at sort of what I'm doing in my writing, what you're doing with your work, Terry, I think it fits into what Joanna Macy, in her work, has called the sort of third part of the Great Turning. She talks about the importance of working to save what's threatened, or what might be also described as resistance actions. So to the kinds of political activities that you mentioned earlier, I would add things like nonviolent resistance, which may become very necessary when it comes to things like Arctic pipelines and so forth. She also talks about the importance of starting to build the new structures that are needed, what the Wobblies used to call building the new society within the shell of the old. And then third, she talked about developing the new kind of consciousness, working to help people come to understand who they are and what the world is and what needs to be done in a new way. And in a way, that's what I was pointing to, too, when I pointed to Paul Hawken. When you look at all of those over 2 million groups together, I see that as reflecting a transformation of consciousness that, as a Buddhist teacher, inevitably that is going to be my sort of primary function. That's not to say that I don't have a responsibility to be engaged and to be encouraging others to engage in those other two types of activities that Joanna mentioned. But as things break down, as we don't know what's going to happen, as we don't know now what's possible and what isn't, the one thing that we can be sure of is how important it is for us to have a different understanding of what the world is, a different understanding of who we are. And I see that as an essential part of the process, because that different understanding of what it means to be human, of what life and society is all about, that will need to come into play as times become difficult. And I think inevitably when we think about our writings and our work, inevitably that's what we would naturally tend to focus on. Sorry, I'm just repeating myself now.
Well, you know, David, one of the ways that, well, wait, before I dig further into that, let me mm-hmm. pick up a side thread that I do think is important to address, because, you know, as Buddhism has combined itself with the West and is transforming itself as it is combining itself with the West, we are now in the midst of Buddhism finally going mainstream. Mindfulness is on CNN, it's on the cover of Time magazine, there are articles all the time, Wisdom 2.0, it's going totally mainstream. But it seems to me that the aspect of Buddhism that's going mainstream is a very narrow slice of it that really is often being kind of co-opted for the purpose of helping us have a kind of clearer, simpler quality of attention that enables us to more happily be cogs in the social machine. The transformational qualities of an engaged Buddhism that have been woven through everything you and I have both been saying are not what's going mainstream. That's almost what's being excised from the form of Buddhism that is going mainstream. Do you observe this too?
Yes, although I think I have a more more long-run positive view than you might, at least from what you said there, Terry. You know, there was a time early in my Zen practice when I thought this is something that Zen is something that everyone's going to want to do, very naive indeed. And once I accepted that, no, Buddhist practice, for example, is only going to appeal to quite a small percentage of U.S. and world population, then you ask, well, how is the impact going to happen? And I think the mainstreaming of mindfulness, for all of its limitations, I think is in certain ways quite hopeful. Yes, given the kind of individualistic society that we're living in, there are definitely problems, although I think that they're probably smaller than what you've been saying. In other words, I think a lot of mindfulness, when I think about the way that mindfulness is being used to help with chronic pain, to help with in schools and all that, I don't have any objections to that. I don't see any problem. I do see problems, as I'm sure you do, when it's used, say, in a corporate situation where the bottom line is helping to make the employees more efficient and therefore more profitable. In other words, rather than reducing somebody's workload, you give them a mindfulness course so that they can multitask more efficiently, that sort of thing. There's definitely a problem there, but I also think there's a kind of developmental arc here that's going to be very interesting to see, because as you develop mindfulness, something happens in and of itself, not always, of course, but there's nonetheless something, I think, quite transformative in that a certain number of people will find themselves, without necessarily understanding what's going on, going deeper. And I think that will be opening the door to possibilities that they initially wouldn't have anticipated. So
I completely agree with that.
That is the
silver lining in the kind of stripped down aspects of what seem to be gaining mainstream acceptability. I think a lot of people will begin meditating, and lots of good things are going to happen. All of them will be contained within the constraints of what's acceptable to mainstream culture, and more, you know, that is a good, and that it's a good that has a kind of who knows the potentials of how good that can ultimately get. It can give birth to lots of good things. I agree with that completely. On the other hand, what I don't see is one of the things that has happened is in the change that's taken place in public discourse, the balkanization of the public sphere that's happened since the advent of the internet is that nobody's really talking to each other across, you know, people aren't talking to people who are really, really different from one another, and journalism is sort of disappearing. So we're dealing with a lot of tough changes. The qualities of public discourse, in some respects, seem to be degenerating. And what it is to be participants, clearly we're both, to some degree, you know, intellectuals or spiritual intellectuals, and we're joining together with other spiritual intellectuals. Probably many of our listeners would fall into that same category, people who are really thoughtfully, deeply looking beyond the obvious into the causes of the conditions of life altogether, not only conditional life, but even the beyond that into the unconditioned. And as we do that, for me, there's another important thing to bring forward, which is this kind of paradoxical interrelationship between well-being, between a kind of intuition of the fundamental okayness of our being and urgency, that things are at once totally perfect exactly as they are, and a total mess that urgently needs our attention. And to find our way into that in a way that allows us to be a growing in our own fundamental okayness and happiness and full acceptance and lightheartedness and freedom and joy and be participants from that foundation of well-being. And then also, though, having completely, you know, no Pollyanna-ish glossing over of the horrible suffering that is already all around us and in some ways accelerating or deepening, and caring deeply about that, being completely unbuffered from the horrors of that, being both sort of, and it doesn't seem to me that it's a mediocre splitting of the difference of these extremes, but a kind of unbuffered exposure to the extremes simultaneously, that there's almost a tantric tension that transforms my being the more I'm released into that. And that feels so important, and it feels underrepresented in the ways that we talk with one another. It's almost like we have to break taboos to be either as happy or as upset as is appropriate, and that the quality of the culture of real spiritual activism would be far more feelingly raw, intimate, and deep than it tends to be. And this is actually one of my biggest critiques of American Buddhist culture, is that it tends toward a kind of almost a mediocre equanimity that isn't mm-hmm. really at the level of what I've just described. Do you find that mm-hmm. yourself?
Wow, you've just described the new Bodhisattva path better than I've ever been able to do, Terry. Thank you for that. I mean, that's my sense of exactly what's needed. And in response to your question, I actually can give a different answer now than I would have been able to give 2 weeks ago, because I recently came back from a gathering of Buddhist teachers, over 200 Buddhist teachers, at the Omega Institute in upstate New York. And to me, that was quite extraordinary, even transformative, insofar as I saw for the first time the kind of focus on social engagement that you and I are talking about. Over the course of our full 3 days, the whole of the second day was about social justice, especially dealing with issues of diversity, inclusion, gender relations. And most of the third full day was on climate issues. And whereas in the past I've so often had the response of, you know, this isn't where we should be going, it wasn't that way at all. It was like people were open to it. This is what they wanted to hear. This is what they wanted to talk about. And this is my sense of that gathering. We had, what, maybe 240 total teachers, including a large contingent from Europe. This is, to some extent, the future of American Buddhism. So, in a way, I had a sense of fruition that the kind of thing that I've been concerned about for quite a while and trying to talk about it really seems to be getting through. I did give a talk there on why Buddhism and the West need each other, why the concern for social transformation and personal transformation are really have to go together, and people got it. There wasn't resistance. They see the point. And so because of that, I have a much more hopeful sense about where American and Western Buddhism generally is going. Now, that may be a bit naive, and it's certainly too early to get too excited, but something does seem to be happening in line with Buddhism's own emphasis on impermanence and insubstantiality. Buddhism is transforming in the way that I think it needs to. So I guess I find that very heartening.
Yeah, that's great. I'm happy to hear that. That's, definitely good news. I want to see and feel more of that. It feels to me,
me too.
Like, and not just among, I mean, this is another thing. I think of Buddhism as maybe one of the most important, but still a subset of a much larger culture of people who are in one way or another awakening, you know, some of whom are on, you know, Hindu or Sufi or Jewish or Christian paths, and others of whom are not affiliated with any tradition, and some of whom would just, we would think of them as being more involved in psychological self-improvement and self-discovery. But the this larger kind of movement of people who you know, sometimes identify as spiritual but not religious are tending as a group to be a group of people who tend to feel pretty isolated, like they are different, they're outside the mainstream, they don't have a lot of power, they don't have a lot of cohesion, and yet taken together we might be bigger than even all the born-again Christians in the country. And that is a an optical illusion of impotence that can only be overcome by us coming into a different kind of dialogue with one another. And my convening of this series is just one of the embodiments of my feeling that I have to be that process of that, that discourse coming into being. And, gosh, I'm seeing the time. Is there something you want to say before I make the announcements?
Well, I mean, one, there's so many things still to say, but in a way, there's something generational happening here, isn't there? It's like just what you mentioned about the shift from the established churches, which are losing people for the most part, and more people who say that they're spiritual but not religious. I mean, that seems to be the case for an increasing number of younger people. So part of the evolutionary change we're talking about is happening, but it's generational. The other thing refers back to what you were talking about, the breakdown in political discourse. It seems to me that a lot of the kind of political stalemates that we're experiencing now has to do with the fact that in this very large country, there are places and people and contexts that are evolving spiritually, psychologically, a lot more quickly than others, right? And so on the one hand, you have a lot of places in this country where consciousness hasn't changed significantly since the 50s or early 60s, and you have other places where, given the intensity of interaction, an awful lot has happened, and so that's a lot of the strain in the political and social conversation. People are at such different places, but again, it seems to me it's the older people who tend to become more, who tend to be more conservative, and somehow the younger ones are sort of bearing the brunt of bringing in this new consciousness that is happening, and it's important within our spiritual traditions then to really be very very sensitive to that and very welcoming to the role of young people.
Yeah, well, in for me that boils down to being willing to learn from people younger than myself. I mean, that to have a real humility and openness that is that senses that emergence is alive and we never know where it's coming from, and to be in a sense a universal student of what is new coming into being everywhere, you know, what is alive. It's time now to invite those of you who are listening, if you'd like to ask questions, and I want to encourage you to go ahead and do so. If you're even slightly in doubt, just please lean in, press *2 on your telephone if you've dialed in, or if you've you're listening via computer, please type your question into the Instant Teleseminar window. First, I'd like to make sure you know how to find out more about David Loy and his work. Information on his forthcoming events, including talks, workshops, and retreats, is available on his website, which is davidloy.org. And this website also has links to his videos, podcasts, blogs, and articles. He's published over 10 books, including his best-selling Money, Sex, War, Karma, and the world is made of stories, as well as Lack and Transcendence, which we've been talking about. That's available as a Kindle book as well. His latest book, just out this year, is A New Buddhist Path, Enlightenment, Evolution, and Ethics in the Modern World. And you can find out more about all the books, but also additional articles and interviews and all kinds of things on his website. I also want to let you know more about me and what I do. My work is dedicated to human transformation on all scales, focusing on both the inner and the outer work. And you can find a rich body of articles, blog posts, audios and videos, events and more. And you can connect with my mailing list at terrypatton.com. The deepest way to work with me is in person, and the best opportunity to do that this year in the United States will be August 16th through 21st, when I'll be leading a six-day retreat at Esalen in Big Sur, California. This is when you'll have a chance to go deepest with me in really ideal circumstances at one of the most beautiful practice spaces in the world. It's called Embodying the Intelligence of Your Heart and Soul. I offered this last year, and our group really fell in love with each other and catalyzed amazing transformational changes in, I think, all our lives. If you're in the United States, I hope you'll plan your summer so you can join me. I'll also be teaching in Cuernavaca, Mexico, September 4th through 6th, and I'll be speaking in Montreal in late September and in Paris in early October. You can find out more about all these at terrypatton.com. Now, let's take a look at the questions. And again, if you've called in on the phone, press star 2 to raise your hand. If you're listening online, type in a question, and we'll be able to see it there. Okay. Well, let's take a live question here from Maura Collins. Hi. You're live. Please introduce yourself. Hello? Well, something's not working technically. Sorry. I'll go to the webcast and we have a question from Sherry in Auburn. Can I be faithful for my desire to be a sincere activist without falling into againstness, without coming from the mystic? It has been my experience that I can't, so my search is to access a state more often. What ways, in addition to meditation, have you found? So, I'm not sure that was phrased exactly as she meant it, but I see a question in there. Is there something there you'd like to address, David?
Yes, and so do I. It's also quite a challenging one. When we normally think about action, social action, social engagement, from a Western perspective, especially given the kind of history coming out of, say, the Judeo-Christian, it tends to too easily fall back into us versus them, because good versus evil, right? We're the good guys, they're the bad guys. And from a Buddhist perspective, it's very important, because Buddhism doesn't emphasize good versus evil, but rather a very different duality or a different tension between delusion versus wisdom or ignorance versus awakening. It's important to get a sense that the fundamental problem we're up against is not sort of evil, nasty people doing bad things to the rest of us, but that we're all somehow sort of caught up in networks of delusion. And so the challenge is to generate action that is motivated not by anger or dualistic us versus them, but an involvement and engagement that's based on love. I mean, I think this is the point of the spiritual practice. It sounds like the questioner is a little concerned about the mystical and doesn't want to go there. Well, I don't know if this is mystical or not, but the whole point of Buddhism, as I understand it, is to help us overcome the delusion of separate self and to realize the sense in which we are, we're all part of each other, and each of us is a manifestation of each other, a manifestation of the whole. And it's this kind of approach that I think enables us to act in the world out of love. There's this wonderful quotation from Nisargadatta, not a Buddhist, of course, and a Neo-Advaitin, but he put it so perfectly. When I look inside and see that there's no me, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. And that's the two sides of our practice that Terry and I have been trying to talk about. And whatever engagement we're going to have in the world, I think it has to be based on that love and understanding and involvement that doesn't dualize, even in situations that tend to fall back into that. Terry, I don't know if you wanted to add to that.
Well, I think not, just because there are a number of other questions, and
I
want to get to more folks. And there is another live caller I'd like to open up. This the caller ID is Vincent James in Loveland, Colorado. You're on the air. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Super.
Yes, I can.
I'm James Vincent from Colorado, and I've found in learning about Buddhism and seeing how it's being taught is the Four Noble Truths have been overwhelmingly forgotten and not taught. And so many, especially Zen Buddhism, seems to even avoid mentioning it so much. And that's the the population as a whole is really unfamiliar with that, and that's the whole foundation of Buddhism, is the Four Noble Truths.
And what's the significance of that that you would maybe like David
taught.
To address? Just that you think that, and what positive difference would it make if it were taught?
Well, people would understand, have a much more appreciation of what the purpose is of Buddhism, rather than being led around in circles with Zen Buddhism and various others. I've seen various Buddhist websites that try to give you an introduction to Buddhism without telling you what it is.
Well, I think it's important not to be sectarian here. There are different types of Buddhism, and I guess I might disagree with you in the sense that I see that Buddhism isn't just what the Buddha said, and by the way, we don't know exactly what he said. I mean, the Pali Canon wasn't written down for some 300 to 400 years, so it's not always so easy to pick out exactly what's genuine in there. But in addition to that, Buddhism is also the way the tradition has developed, and it's become nuanced in that there are other ways of talking besides the Four Noble Truths. I mean, the Four Noble Truths is a wonderful way of capturing what the Buddha and what Buddhism is about, but there are other ways of talking as well, such as myself as a Zen student are able to appreciate. And so I really appreciate the move in the last generation toward what's sometimes called non-sectarian Buddhism, not saying that, say, only Theravada is correct, or only Zen, or only Tibetan Buddhism is correct. And yet, in another way, I'd also like to emphasize what you were saying about the Four Noble Truths, because what's so marvelous about that way of expressing the Dharma, of course, is that that is a kind of template that can be used in a number of ways.
David, can you explain what the Four Noble Truths are? Not every listener will believe to be aware of what they are.
Thanks for that, Terry. So, Four Noble Truths are the most common way of summarizing what the Buddha said. So the Four Noble Truths are life is suffering, the cause of suffering is craving, but there's an end to our suffering, and that is awakening or nirvana. And finally, the path that leads to awakening is the Noble Eightfold Path. What's so wonderful about that, I think, or one of the many wonderful things about it, is that this template can also be used to look at other kinds of issues, including social suffering, or what I sometimes call social dukkha, institutionalized dukkha. So we can look at that as a form of suffering. We can ask, what are the causes? We can ask, what are the solutions? And we can ask, what do we need to do in order to get to those solutions? So in that sense, I think it's possible, and more than that, I think we're even called upon to sort of bring that fundamental framework to bear looking at the larger kinds of social and ecological challenges that we face today.
Mm. Thank you. And thank you, James, for your question.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah. And again, if you want to raise your hand for a live question, just press star 2. I'm going to go to some questions, some more questions that have been typed in. Sylvia, several questions came in from Mexico, where people are really up against a lot of frustrating issues. Actually, I'll read the one from Beatriz in Cuernavaca. I live in a country in which the government is at the service of foreign transnational corporations, and in this sense is working against its own native people. And the population in general are quite unaware and passive, with a few exceptions. Do you have any suggestions?
Wow. Well, that's certainly a big challenge. I mean, not being Mexican and not, frankly, not being so aware of the situation there, it's hard for me to be able to say anything very specific. I mean, in a sense, the problem that you mentioned, in some ways it's different. In other ways, it's not so different, I think, from the problem we face here in the United States. I mean, our economy and our political system is dominated by these mega corporations that are, you know, working for their own benefit, not for ours. It's true that we here in the U.S., just by virtue of the way colonialism and neocolonialism are organized, that we have kind of consumer benefits that many people in Mexico don't. But I think we all have this larger problem of dealing with a social system that is now dominated by these kinds of institutions that, as I started out by talking about, have taken on a life of their own. Yeah. In terms of specifics, as I said, it's really hard to know what to do given the way that you made the question about people not knowing what's going on. I mean, in a way, that does point, doesn't it, to one of the major things that needs to happen, which is part of this broader educational process of helping people to wake up to what's really going on. And as I remember, being a very Catholic and a very Christian country, there's a special challenge in introducing this new understanding of the spiritual path, so that it's not simply about acting in a certain kind of way that's going to qualify for some pie in the sky after we die, but really emphasizing that it's about transforming ourselves now in ways that can also develop ways to engage and challenge these larger corporate and comparable interests there. I mean, we also have within the Latin American, we have the whole tradition of liberation theology, and I think it's very exciting the way that some of that is coming together in conversation with socially engaged Buddhism, and in that sense pointing new directions. But in terms of being really specific of knowing what to do, I wish I could say more, but I can't.
You know, one of the things that I feel can be said is that for every one of us, there is a deep contemplation. Like, we each have to find our own way in the midst of a particular life with particular constraints and particular talents and particular passions and particular abilities. Mm. And it's not really ever possible to prescribe to anyone how to do their practice individually, inner work or externally, outer work. So the unique constellation of of forces that you're facing in Mexico tends to create an overwhelming kind of sadness and a sense of helplessness and a sense of despair and a sense of impotence that is more pronounced even than what we experience here in the United States, where we're enjoying the fruits of the way the international system has displaced so much wealth to us. We're just more comfortable here, and we have more rule of law and basic protections and safety underneath us. And so, you know, the one of the biggest things I think is to be in conversation across these cultural barriers. You know, I may be in a culture that is richer than you, but I'm not better than you. My existential situation is not edged up against some of the challenges that you are, and yet as a human people, we are going to need to find our way forward under conditions that are much worse than those in Mexico. In many countries in the world, it's much, much worse than Mexico. When you compare yourself to people in the United States, you've got it bad. When you compare yourself to people in so many other countries, I shouldn't name one, you know, you've got it good. And so you're actually on the front lines of something existentially that I need to learn about, that, you know, I can be your student. And the fact that you're caring about this and feeling this helplessness makes it more alive here in this in the hermeneutic circle, the cultural conversation that we're in. We can be more intimately, like, so much fear, so much despair, so much sense of helplessness gets drawn up, and to the degree that we, you know, this is a spiritual challenge to find your way to your own heart, which is eternally optimistic. You know, it rises, it beats every moment, you know, like the sun rising. There's a kind of quality of spring, of life renewing, and to be that hopefulness in the midst of it, then there may be things that you can do. Maybe it involves helping raise awareness in certain ways. Maybe it isn't going to be a direct political or social transformation of Mexican culture. Maybe it's going to be the building of a subculture among some middle-class Mexican people who are able to have this level of conversation with you such that you do something different. And there are lots of different ways, and what it is that you're going to do is going to be unique. And finding your way, just never, ever abandoning the fundamental commitment to the mystery of this koan, and to trust that your awareness is the signal of a possibility that hasn't fully finished realizing itself, and for us to be brothers and sisters in that contemplation, that feels like something real that I can say to you as you presence that.
The other thing that's implicit in what you just said, Terry, is you know, the importance of community. I mean, insofar as this questioner or any of us feel that we're isolated and separate and this is our own individual problem, but there's incredible frustration. But what this points to, of course, is not only the need, the bodhisattva need to find our own way, which accords with our own temperament and situation, also to find others to work with, because without that, it's just almost overwhelmingly oppressive. But when we are with other people who share our concerns and want to work together, then so many new things become possible that weren't otherwise.
Beautiful. Thank you. Let me offer a couple of other questions, because we're getting so close to the end. I'd like to at least presence there's some very intelligent, interesting questions that have been asked, and I'm not sure that long answers to all of them are possible, but maybe they can come forward and it can enrich our discourse. Ursina from Switzerland wrote in, concern for social justice, the environment, and climate is very much mainstream over here in Middle Europe, more than in the United States, in my experience. But what we lack almost completely is a spiritual perspective, which often leads to burnout and discouragement. I think our state of consciousness is of primary importance, but much more difficult to introduce into the society than social concerns. And
I mean, if I could just respond very briefly to that.
I think
the challenge is the same here. It's like the bringing together the social concern for social justice and so forth with the personal spiritual transformation is still in its early days. The difference is, I think we have more Buddhism. I think Buddhism, frankly, is more developed here in the United States. There are more teachers, more exposure. And to some extent, I think it's still fairly early days in Europe. I think it's happening. I mean, as I mentioned, we had a contingent of about 40 Buddhist teachers at this last conference 2 weeks ago, and things are definitely growing there. But I think it's true that we in the United States, Buddhism has taken deeper root more quickly.
Yeah, I think that you've, so to respond quickly, there is a delegitimization of spirituality. Often the word New Age is used as a pejorative to more or less dismiss the whole conversation we're having.
Yeah.
And that's just another sign of social resistance. And I think that there are skillful means. You may find yourself able to communicate across that bridge. And it is true. I don't think that there is a way to address this. One of the reasons that I think, you know, both David and I are emphasizing the spiritual dimension, because we don't think that activism based in lack is going to work, basically. Mary Linda in Ohio wrote a really thoughtful question. As an individual, I can volunteer and become active to serve. But if my survival needs are met through the systems of corporate structure and government structure, then I hesitate, even though these systems are oppressive, because intrinsically there's conditional fear for my needs. So my question is, do we as a more evolved collective begin to build the communities and businesses that more serve our environments that we know are needed for the higher good, truth, and beauty? And as said, build it, and those will come to keep growing the higher communities needed. The question then is, you know, it's a little bit like a reference to the slogan from the Wobblies, you know, the building a new society within the structure,
right,
the shell of the old.
Right. Well, I mean, I think this brings us back to you know, one of the essentials of traditional Buddhism, which encourages a simpler life. I mean, the traditional Buddhist word is something like renunciation, and I don't know that that's quite the right term here, but I think we need to accept that a lot of the comforts that we've come to take for granted, a certain level of consumerism that we enjoy, whether we voluntarily or involuntarily have to give up some of that, I think it's going to happen, and I think the compensation or the way to deal with that is what we were talking about earlier. I think we need to build really strong communities, whether they're Buddhist, spiritual, or just our neighborhood communities of people who care for each other and are going to be there for each other when the hard times come. I mean, if things fall apart in some very profound ways, the most important thing is not going to be that bag of brown rice or lentils in our basement, but it's going to be whether we are part of a community that is working in that direction. So, I mean, one way or another, I think there's a certain kind of luxuriousness to the kind of life that we've gotten used to, and we're going to have to give some of that up. And I don't know that that's completely a bad thing.
There are... This is a lovely question that came in from Manuel in Lima. Greetings from Peru, David and Terry. Is there in the Buddhist canon some particular sutra or teaching that could help us to develop this modern approach to engaged Buddhism?
Okay. The Buddha was very much involved, you know, with his society, but in a way that doesn't always sort of translate into the very different kind of society that we have today. I mean, he was very concerned, for example, he was working to teach people a different way of relating to family life. He was encouraging kings to rule in a different kind of a way. But as I said earlier, I think the important thing about Buddhism is not so much that it gives us the specific kinds of structural answers that we might like, right? Like, you know, what kind of economy should we have, or what kind of government should we have? It really doesn't give us those examples, but what it does emphasize, and this is throughout many sutras, especially in the Mahayana tradition, it does emphasize the importance of an inner spiritual personal transformation that is not simply self-focused, but that leads us to realize that our own well-being can't really be separate from the well-being of other people, and that encourages us to engage out of that. So, as I said earlier, I think Buddhism has a lot to say about how we engage, but it doesn't give us the kinds of specific answers that I think many of us would like.
Thank you. And thank you, Manuel, for that question. We have a number of, you know, very thoughtful questions that are kind of hard to answer in a short way. I'd like to presence them. Greg in Altadena typed in, what would you advise members of those 2 million groups Hawking researched on how to connect with each other?
Wow, what a great question.
Yeah.
And I don't have an answer to it. Maybe my 23-year-old son, who's so much more wired and connected than I am, maybe he would, but I certainly don't. Yeah.
Terry, well, you know, it seems to me that we are all members of some of those 2 million groups, and this reaching out to one another and this willingness to come forward in this heightened okayness and not okayness that brings forth the potential for a different level of honesty and intimacy and vulnerability and unbuffered feeling, presence and tenderness is in that spirit, something is ready to grow, and that would be my only comment there. Here's a very provocative and challenging question to answer and respond to, David. Maura has raised her hand again, and actually so is someone else. Let's see if we can get a good connection here. You're live. Please introduce yourself. Hello? Okay, Maura Collins is not there, but the other person is, since we've done this. Peter in Dixon.
It's actually his wife.
Hi.
Deborah Cohen. Hi. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's wonderful. I really appreciate it. So my question has to do with the idea of the social dukkha, as you talk about it, David. But I read a book called The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, by Andrew Harvey. And in the book, he talks about, and I don't think he put it this way, it's been years since I read it, but that for many people, the need is to have their hearts broken in order to care enough for the suffering of other life forms, other human beings. And I just wonder if you could comment about that. So by having their hearts broken, you know, some personal connection with the tragic occurrence of events unfolding.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, I think many of us come to Buddhism because there is some, well, I mean, virtually all of us, if we're going to make the effort, the time, etc., to actually, say, meditate and follow a contemplative path, it's because there is some kind of suffering in our own life. Now, that can be a very personal thing. It could be a simply kind of existential challenge, but it can also be, as you point to, that we can become aware of the suffering in the world, and become aware of it in a way that we don't feel separate from us, that it really touches us, that it touches us so very deeply. I think this has really important implications for the way that Buddhism has been understanding karma. I mean, too much we've been, the way the tradition developed in Asia, just to say it very quickly, the focus was on my own individual karma because of what I did in past lifetimes and so forth, and that therefore what I deal with is simply the results of what I did, my own karmic stream is separate from that of other people. And I think what we're realizing more and more in the modern world, of course, is that it just doesn't work that way, that our social, institutional, personal dukkhas, that they're all connected with each other, and how important it is not just to become aware of that at some intellectual level, but as you say, to feel that, in which case our hearts are broken, and that just really cuts through in such a direct and immediate way the kind of self preoccupation or narcissism that otherwise our culture, the kind of individualistic trance that our culture otherwise tends to encourage. But thank you so much for that.
Yeah, thank you. I resonate a lot with Andrew. He brings forward in a way a very different spirit in this than generally emotionally the Buddhist community is sort of balanced and reasonable and rational, you know, because it is a non-theistic tradition, and this emphasis on passion and on heartbreak and feeling is more characteristic of more devotional traditions, and I do think that something important is added to the conversation there. It's one of the reasons that I don't stand strictly inside a Buddhist orientation, which is in some ways our richest spiritual tradition, because I particularly value this. And this is, you know, I taught, some of you know that I taught a seminar with Andrew earlier this year, and we both, you know, deeply, you know, this, to some degree, the core of all this is our hearts and our care. And our relationship even to our own awakening depends upon being deeply heart vulnerable to that root experience of lack and anxiety that David so beautifully describes in his writings. And the conversation has to be a passionate conversation in order to be a real conversation. To the degree that we abstract ourselves and make it simply a dignified and intelligent conversation, something begins to be lost, I think. And that might be a good place, since we are at the end. David, I'd be interested to hear your response to that.
I think that's exactly right. Those who are familiar with the Bhagavad Gita know that it describes different paths. And I think Buddhism, with the emphasis on meditation, there's a kind of emphasis on mind, at least in the Western sense, the intellectual side or the thinking side, whereas what Andrew and the more theistic traditions tend to focus on is the more devotional, the more heart-opening side. And then, of course, there's the karma yoga as well, the path of action, the more practical sort of getting out there and doing stuff. But I think it's also worth mentioning that a word that's often translated as mind into English, when you look at the Sino-Japanese term, the original Sino-Japanese term, tsin in Chinese and shin in Japanese, it's actually heart-mind. So that distinction isn't made in East Asia in the way that that we tend to do it in the West, that there is a sense in which it's not simply intellectual pursuit by any means, but that, I mean, I think this opening up of the heart, whether we talk about it in quite the same way in Buddhism or not, I mean, I think that that's an essential part of it. We have to be touched at that level, or there's still, in effect, a real deep sense of separation and duality between us and others. It's not enough just to get some kind of intellectual insight there.
Yeah. Thank you so much, David. I wish we could go on for another hour and a half, because this is so rich. You know, folks, if
you
value what's going on here, please support this work by letting others know about it. You can forward the email you received. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you want to learn more about David Loy and his work, please buy and read his books and go to davidloy.org to get on his mailing list. And you're also invited to go to terrypatton.com and sign up for my mailing list and find out about my upcoming teaching events. Thanks so much for joining David and me today. And goodbye, everybody.
And thank you, Terry.
Yeah, thanks so much, David.